The theme song for the sequel cast is written and performed by Mark with a C. The sequel cast is also a proud member of the Battleship Retention podcast fleet. You can listen to the sequel cast streaming on the Stitcher app at Stitcher.com. Get more episodes of the sequel cast from sequelcast.com. Enjoy the show.
Shit, Biscuit, I knew I should have
I get to the president now while he's busy.
Forget it, he's on the other side of town and we got no wheels. The deal is off.
Just calm down.
After the credits roll, there's always more to tell. Especially when the video sales are doing really well. From Shock Treatment to Jason X to Police Academy 6. This is Sequel Cast. And they are unsurpassed at following a franchise until the bitter end. This is Sequel Cast. And your hosts have asked that I inform you that the show will now begin.
Hello and welcome to the Sequel Cast. The Sequel Cast is a podcast looking at movies in a franchise, one film at a time. This time around, we're doing a franchise. We had you, yes, you, the listeners, vote on what we should do next. And the winner at the last second, I think it might have been some shenanigans going on, but for whatever reason, John Carpenter's Escape duology with Snake Plissken vaulted to the top above the runners-up, which were Terminator, and which has a new film coming out this year, Terminator Genesis. And I'm trying to think the other one. I said it last week. Do you recall?
Thrasher? Did it involve aliens or predators?
Neither. The other runner-up was the Marvel Phase 1, that first batch of films from the Marvel studios.
Oh, yes.
So, who knows? We might do those later this year. We'll have to see. But it's a lot of people were gunning for Terminator, so I'm kind of surprised. I'm not upset. And you, Thrasher, especially, have a lot of history with this film that we will get into. Again, website is sequelcast.com. Check out all the past episodes and so forth. You know the drill. So Escape from New York. I believe this might be the first John Carpenter film we've discussed on the sequel cast.
Indeed, I think it is.
And man, he's one of those directors that just didn't do anything for like 10 years in the 2000s. You know, he did that movie,
Ghost of Mars?
Ghost of Mars, which is... It's not awful, but it's uninspired, I think would be a safe way to put it.
It's a neat idea that it's horribly executed.
Yeah, and I think that's part of John Carpenter's problem, is he has these very grand ideas and never really has the budget to pull it off. And sometimes he can make it work, and sometimes he can't. You know, and you know, recently he came out with a movie called The Ward, W-A-R-D, which I've never seen, but it's supposed to be more of a sort of low-budget, a bunch of chicks in an insane asylum kind of movie. And he did a few episodes of that Masters of Horror show that was on either HBO or Showtime. I don't recall which one.
I believe he did the Cigarette Burns episode.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was one of the ones he did. And the other one he did was called Pro-Life, about a demon that attacks an abortion clinic. So, there you go. And both of those were co-written by film critic Drew McWeeny, who does a lot of good work on HitFix with his motion captured section on the website. I've been a fan of his for years since he started as Moriarty on Ain't It Cool News. But regardless, we're not talking about our favorite online film critics and what we think of film criticism, although I think they'd make a hell of a special episode. We're talking about Escape from New York. When did you first see this, Thrasher?
I'm not sure, because I've always loved John Carpenter's work. And I will admit, there are a handful of dogs in his filmography.
Yeah.
But this is not one of them. This is one of those movies where I don't know exactly where I first saw it, because it's kind of one of those movies that's felt like it's always been with me. The first time I can consciously remember seeing it would have been in the early 90s. It had cropped up on, I think it was TNT's Monster Vision, hosted by Joe Bob Briggs.
Joe Bob Briggs, yeah.
Yeah, but this is the first, although reviewing it for the sequel cast, this is the first time I've seen it from beginning to end in a long time. And possibly the first time, because it occurs to me this may be one of those movies where I've seen the whole thing, but only in large chunks on cable throughout my childhood.
Interrupted with commercials, yeah. The last time I saw this, it's been a while. was in the late 90s when I worked at a Blockbuster Video and I could rent out, I don't know, five movies at a time. And this is when everything was videotaped. You know, DVD just barely came out and we had no inventory because nobody had DVD players when they came out. People thought DVDs were going to be like Laserdisc and only be a format for the super rich and the collector. And
but
you see how history.
All be glad that it wasn't.
Right. We can see how history repeats itself. Blu-ray was like that for a long time. And then now it just seems like everything's going more digital with on-demand stuff than the physical media. And yeah, that's a separate discussion. But Escape from New York, I first learned of Snake Plissken through a trailer for the sequel, Escape from L.A. And it was an unusual trailer in that it showed a full scene from the film. I think Snake tosses a can up in the air and shoots three times real fast and knocks out these bandito types. Well, and the trailer's like, Snake is back. And I said out loud, who the fuck is Snake? And like, there's other people that said the same thing in tandem with me that I didn't even know in the theater. Like, I swear to God.
Well, it's so funny because this is before Escape from L.A. came out. Escape from New York really was a cult film. The only people who really knew about it
right.
were diehard John Carpenter fans and B movie buffs. Although I there's a comment about that trailer I'd like to make, but we probably should save it for the next episode.
Sure.
Because you saw was the second trailer. The first trailer.
I see. It was more normal, right?
Well, no. It was even crazier, but I'll save that
okay.
for next week.
Yeah. We'll save that for next week. But anyway, you know, and so then later when I worked at Blockbuster, I rented Escape from L.A., watched that first, and saw Escape from New York. And that's quite the transition. So Escape from New York came out in 81. You know, I'm looking at John Carpenter's had quite a big filmography. I mean, his most influential film by far is the original Halloween. Almost half of his filmography has been remade at this point. I'm exaggerating a little bit there, but like Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween, The Fog,
The Thing.
Okay, maybe that's it. You know, anyway, like half a dozen of his films have been remade. And John Carpenter, I love his attitude towards it. He's like, you know, if you want to watch the originals, you can go to the store and buy them. They're right there on my shelf at home. I get a check. Sometimes I get a producer credit. And speaking of Escape from New York, I might as well talk about that now before we jump into the movie. They've been trying to get like a remake of this off the ground for a while. And originally it was going to have, I think, Gerard Butler was being toyed with to play the lead. And that kind of fell through. But I think the latest stab at it, they're really close to getting it done. They have a pretty good script. And John Carpenter is going to be involved as executive producer, which doesn't mean much. It means he'll probably be in for a meeting or so. But that's more involvement than he usually has. I think he called his remake a fucking piece of shit of The Fog that came out with the dude from Smallville. So and I think this is actually a film you could remake pretty well. When I see Escape from New York, I immediately think of a movie. This came out in 81. I think of a movie from the late 70s called The Warriors, directed by Walter Hill. Have you seen that?
Yes. And actually, there's a scene early on where we see our first denizen of New York step out of the shadows. And the very first thing that entered my mind was, Warriors, come out and play.
Right. I mean, it has, and John Carpenter did this lighting a lot. So did, you know, Walter Hill, who not only directed Warriors, but 48 Hours and Streets of Fire, which is a movie I've been meaning to see for years. In that, it has a lot of red lighting, a lot of harsh red lighting. A lot of it's like in the gritty city streets. Kind of Mad Max, like an urban Mad Max post-apocalyptic thing going on.
Well, that's something I got to applaud this movie for, because within the boundaries of New York, which in the future of 1997 is a maximum security prison colony, like
right.
It might as well be post-apocalyptic in there, and yet... It's one of the most, I think, well-realized post-apocalypses. No one is stylish in this post-apocalypse. Everyone is wearing scavenged rags. Everything looks like it's falling apart and barely maintained. Like, it's not a beautiful post-apocalyptic war zone.
Well, and because it's set in an urban setting, the city, a lot of people have been to a big city, or even a medium-sized city, you know? It's not that hard to find. And compared to Mad Max, which feels sort of alien, frankly, with a desert environment, which is, you know, it makes that it's set in the city, New York City specifically, even though this happened to be filmed not in New York City. It was filmed in St. Louis, Missouri, when the town was in bad economic shape and they could basically do whatever the hell they wanted and dress it up pretty nice. They did film stuff around the Statue of Liberty for some establishing shots.
Well, that's something that grounds this movie in so much reality, is there's lots of, like, iconic things. You've got the Statue of Liberty, you've got that classic New York skyline where you can see the Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, and the World Trade Center towers.
Right.
But then the two other ones that really stand out is when the cannibals come out of the sewer and Snake is kind of looking for a place to hide. He hides in one of the chock-full-of-nuts coffee shops, which I don't think those coffee shops are around anymore. Listeners, if you actually happen to have one of those coffee shops in operation near you, I'd love to hear from you. I think that's just a coffee brand now. But the other one that just tickled me so much, towards the climax of the film, when Snake is in that arena in the Duke's lair, there's this one guard that's, you know, he's armed with a nail-covered baseball bat, but his shield is one of those old round Coca-Cola signs.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't hide the logo at all. It's right there.
No. Well, probably at the time you didn't need to pay a fee to the place to do product placement, you know. It just sort of, because people were using what they have around them as armor and whatever, it just makes it seem that much more real. We got some comments on the Facebook page about Escape from New York.
Oh, yes.
Some buddies of mine that teach English in Japan, John and Chuck, hey, if you're listening, they said they love John Carpenter's music. And I have to correct them on that. It's by John Carpenter and Alan Howarth. So it was a co-production of the music. And it's, I mean, I think the music in this is great, especially in the opening credits. Within, like, two notes, you know exactly that this film was made in the 80s. And it's not just synth. It's, like, spooky synth.
Well, it's a combination of actual instruments and synth that works really well. And I love that John Carpenter scores his own movies, but I also love his minimalist compositions, which, you know, three best you'll probably hear will be Halloween, Escape from New York, and The Thing.
Right. I mean, I think I've talked about this in the show before, but this past Halloween with a buddy of mine from work, we went to see Alan Howarth, who co-composed a lot of John Carpenter films, including Escape from New York, did a live concert after a theatrical screening of Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Ooh.
And he did music from Escape from New York, but because it was just him on a keyboard, it was just him kind of noodling improv stuff on top of the studio tracks to the movies, which is kind of weird, but I think it's the best he could do. But it was still pretty neat. Like, they had the speakers really pumped up to dialed up to 11, as they say. And did you see John Carpenter came out with an album called John Carpenter's Lost Themes?
Yes, I'd love to hear that.
It's good. You can look it up on Spotify and listen to it that way. It's pretty, it sounds like John Carpenter, and he worked with his son on a lot of the tracks. And I think lately, frankly, John Carpenter's had a lot of fun playing the Xbox 360 and the Xbox One. He likes the video games and all that stuff, and he worked really hard, and he deserves his semi-retirement, but I don't think he's against directing another movie, but at this point with his age, he had a big career with some successes, and it has to be said, Escape from New York was a success. It grossed over three times its budget. It was John Carpenter's most expensive film he made up to that point in his career. And if you look at 1981 domestic box office gross, it placed number 32. Any guesses for what was above or below it?
A Star Wars movie had to be above it. And below it, a remake of And Baby Makes Three.
Okay, so 81. I might have said 82 by accident. 81, there it was 1 year before Return of the Jedi, so no Star Wars.
Oh, so the Jedi had not returned yet.
Yeah, he was just about to.
The Empire, we were still reeling from the throes of the Empire striking back.
Right, the Empire struck back, hit a triple, and we're waiting for it to be caught and thrown into the infield. And 33rd, you know, so Escape from New York was 32nd in the box office. Above it at 31 was a romantic sort of, I guess, like a female-oriented comedy called Only When I Laugh. And below it at 33 was the sex drama Body Heat.
Huh.
So for some comparison that year, Escape from New York performed better than Friday the 13th 2 and The Final Conflict Omen 3. But it didn't do as good as, say, American Werewolf in London or even something we've talked about on the show, The Great Muppet Caper. But it still was profitable, right? And I think the movie does, as you hinted at, Thrasher, does a great job of atmosphere.
Well, yeah, that's something that struck me rewatching it for the show is just how much this movie just delights in taking its time and teasing you and building up tension and then releasing it in ways you don't expect.
Yeah, now, I mean, given that the movie is a bit older, it takes a little bit to set up the scenario. But once the action gets going, I like how the plot, sort of like the music, is very simple and clear and direct. You're going from point A to point B to point C. And yes, there are surprises along the way, but you have a clear mission that they take great pains to establish in the beginning. And I watched a vintage documentary with John Carpenter on this film, and he mentioned that he considers this like a Western.
You know, I got the exact same vibe, although when it comes down to it, I would say most of John Carpenter's movies are at heart Westerns.
He says that as well, yeah. I mean, you look at this, you even look at John Carpenter's Vampires, right?
Yep. Based on the novel Vampires by John Steakley.
The novel has a dollar sign for the S in Vampires.
Yes, it does.
Title,
it's one of my favorite vampire novels, actually.
You know, John Carpenter was going to do a sequel to Vampires, but only if they let him continue the story of James Woods, and instead they decided to make a direct-to-video sequel starring John Bon Jovi.
Oh, okay, so it's Vampires Las Muertes.
And there's also a third one with an Asian guy in the lead.
Oh, so, Lord.
Sequel cast fodder, maybe? Don't know. I'd rather do From Dusk Till Dawn if we're going to do a vampire thing.
You know, if we ever did an episode, just a special episode just about unfaithful book-to-movie adaptations, I would want vampires to be front and center.
Well, there you go. But with Escape from New York, Kurt Russell in the lead was a real radical choice at the time. He was growing up in all these Disney live-action family films.
He was the computer that wore tennis shoes, as I recall.
Yep. And he also played baseball for a independent baseball team in Portland, Oregon, that his father ran for a few years. There's a good documentary about that called The Battered Bastards of Baseball or something along those lines. And Kurt Russell played for that team as a teenager. But, yeah, regardless, you know, he's trying to shed that image. You know, you think of, like, Johnny Depp doing 21 Jump Street and then deciding to do a John Waters film with Crybaby, kind of mocking his image. Kurt Russell is doing that to even further extreme in Escape from New York. He has a grizzled face that's showing, hey, I'm a man, I can grow facial hair. He has an eye patch.
He's
lifted weights, and he, you know, previously worked with John Carpenter on a made-for-TV movie about Elvis playing Elvis, which I've heard is quite good. I've never seen it.
I've heard it's good as well. Do you know how John Carpenter got the gig directing that?
I don't.
Okay, this comes from an anecdote because Kurt Russell and John Carpenter talk about this on the audio commentary that's on the Big
Trouble
in China.
China.
Yeah. That the way John Carpenter got the gig doing the Elvis movie is that one of the producers for the movie just happened to notice that John Carpenter had scored the music for Halloween and thought, oh, well, this guy must understand music. So we should have him do the Elvis biopic.
You know, the only reason John Carpenter did music for his movies is because he couldn't afford a composer.
And yet it works.
No, he's quite good. There's a certain sound to his soundtracks, and it adds, I think, to the creepy, gritty mood.
And really, who else does that? Who else scores their own movies?
You know, John Carpenter doesn't do it consistently through his career. A few times, or at least with The Thing, he used Ennio Morricone or something, the famous Italian composer, Ennio Morricone, who did all the Clint Eastwood westerns. Speaking of Clint Eastwood, Kurt Russell as Snake Plissken is clearly doing an Eastwood impression that is actually quite good.
Yeah, he's channeling Eastwood with his, you know.
Yeah, it's not subtle.
I'll kill you. I thought you said you were going to kill me. I'm tired. I love how dry he is.
Stop it, I'm not. Yeah, stop it. I'm not jacking off around here. We got to make the drop point pronto.
Oh, that's something else I loved. He's not a quippy action hero. He's just very dry and says what he means.
It's quippy, but it's not like in the Schwarzenegger
vein. Well, there's no obvious jokes. It's just
where it's like an obvious pun. Ice to meet you. Revenge is a dish best served cold. My wife, she's dead and frozen. Let it go.
Or in this case, you know, careful, you might step on a snake in the grass.
Yeah, I mean, he's more like threatening. He's an anti-hero, certainly. And he's only in this mission because he's forced to. He's injected with this thing that'll kill him unless he gets these antibodies. And his mission is to rescue the U.S. president.
Yes.
This rebel faction has,
Well, they hijack Air Force
One. They hijack the Air Force One, cause it to crash, and they have him captive. And he has to rescue the president of the United States.
And this movie shows us that he is a bad enough dude to rescue the president.
Did you know John Carpenter originally filmed a 10-minute introduction sequence that then they decided not to use?
No, I did not know that because they just have that sort of short animation with the voiceover that sounds like Michelle Roddenberry.
It's Jamie Lee Curtis, actually, but
she does a good job. And yet, I'm not even sure the movie needs that. I like that it's there. I love those old timey imitation computer graphics. But
oh yeah, sure.
Everything once the movie begins, everything is revealed so gently that I feel like you probably don't really need that exposition. Although I still love that Chiron, 1997, now.
Yeah. With the original introduction as it was filmed, and they've never had this as a deleted scene on the DVDs, the Blu-rays or whatever, as far as I know. But it would have been a bank heist where Snake and his partner rob a bank, and it's guarded by robots. And they, the job doesn't go well, and the cops come and kill his partner. And then he's arrested. And then that leads into him in the beginning of the film where, they get him and say, we need you for this mission. We're going to wipe your record clean. And I think cutting that is a very wise move.
Yeah, I like
how stark it is. It's a bit of a mystery. You kind of learn a bit about Snake, but not too much, just that he's a badass motherfucker.
Well, he's ex Special Forces, saw too much, lost his faith in the system, and went rogue.
Yeah. And I think, I agree, the film could be even more stark with that, and because of Kurt Russell's performance and how he looks, I mean, are you going to trust a guy with an eye patch, really? And yet, he's the guy they said to rescue the president.
Hey, I know eye patch people. Eye patch people are good people. It's the people that caused them to need the eye patch you got to watch out for.
I love the tagline on this poster, 1997, New York City is a walled maximum security prison. Breaking out is impossible. Breaking in is insane.
I love that.
Yeah, that's, and the artwork is just great, kind of a Dutch angle, slightly tilted. And you see
the head of the Statue of Liberty lying in the middle
of the Statue of Liberty,
which is not something that's in this film. The Statue of Liberty is very intact.
Right. Although, I mean, I think that imagery in the film could have worked. But
true, sure. But then you might have to explain it.
Yep. There's also the joke that Lee Van Cleef, who plays the police commissioner that kind of does the mission briefing, looks a lot like John Carpenter. Which is true.
And he has that ear piercing.
the ear piercing, the mustache. You get Ernest Borgnine, Harry Dean Stanton, a lot of good, solid, old, crusty character actors.
They were treats. I particularly love Ernest Borgnine in this movie.
Did you like the kind of shitty Broadway show that Ernest Borgnine goes to? That's where you sort of get introduced to some of these characters.
Yes, I love that. That everybody's, like, you find that abandoned theater with a marquee that says, like, everybody's coming to New York, but you go in, and there actually is this, like, song and dance drag act of this song, Everyone's Coming to New York. It's just, like, delightful. And I like that, because, you know, these people, all these criminals in New York, they'd want entertainment, so they'd have to make their own. Oh, and you know, the performers on stage, that is the Lomone Spectacular Alternative Theater Troupe.
Are they still in existence?
They, as far as I know, they are. I don't know if they perform regularly anymore. They might only do it like as a special thing. But they do have a website where you can buy their albums, lomone.com. I ended up, after seeing this movie, I ended up going on this little research tangent.
Yeah, originally the script from Escape from New York was written by John Carpenter in the mid-70s as a reaction to Watergate and Nixon's presidency and all that stuff.
Well, it's right there. I mean, it's all, you know, yeah, a lot of corrupt administration, imperial presidencies, and I love that. That's something I think you got far more of in the 70s was politically minded science fiction films.
I'd like to see more of that, frankly. I mean, it seems like a lot of science fiction films with a message, to put a finer point onto it. If you see it anymore, it's done for a budget of like no dollars, and it jumps on Netflix basically the same day it's in like two theaters in New York and LA. Although I really did like that one film that came out 7 years ago. God, shit. It's about the guy that becomes like a part insect man and it has aliens.
Oh, District 9?
District 9, yeah, I think that's it. I thought that one was quite good.
I enjoyed that.
As a commentary. But John Carpenter brought on a buddy of his, Nick Castle, to inject some humor into the script. And he thought we could add something to give this a bit more life and not have it just be a straight action picture.
Oh, I've got a question for you. So, you know, we get a sense why a lot of the criminals are in New York. But I wonder why Ernest Borgnine's character, Cabby, who, true to his name, drives an old beat up cab.
Yes.
What do you think his crime was?
I think it might have started when he was a child as petty theft, and he probably found a situation that was too good to pass up, and he was just too jolly, a bit too relaxed to pull off the job correctly. So I think he tried to maybe rob something from a rich guy's car and got caught.
Well, because I feel like this, in my head, he was like the world's best car thief. And just, you know, stole, you know, ridiculous number of cars from wealthy and politically connected people. And yet, part of me wonders, was he just a stubborn old New Yorker who didn't leave when they turned it into a prison?
That could very well be the case. You look at the film, and I like how, much like they do with Snake Plissken, you get a little bit of detail, a little bit of development with these characters. But it's not like modern films where it seems like everyone has to have a character arc and has to change and has to become a better person by the end of the film and have a breakdown and recover and kill the bad guy, right?
A real, like, hero's journey, if you will.
Yeah, the hero doesn't have a journey. All his sidekicks do as well. And in this, everything is so sparse, you can fill in the blanks. I mean, we can have conversations like we're having right now here in the sequel cast. Listen to more episodes at sequelcast.com, where... Yeah, that was what we call a subtle plug here in the business, where you can say, well, where did that guy come from? You know, we know he kind of has an attitude, and he's kind of jolly, but what is he really hiding? And it opens up all these ideas and fun things to do.
Oh, yeah, well, even
with the characters.
There's so much fun you can have speculating in this movie. Like, for instance, that crazy guy who's like the Duke's assistant. I really feel like he's one of the subway cannibals who kind of got domesticated. He's just so unhinged, and his body movements are so insectile.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it just leaves things open. I think the fight kind of in the ersatz arena we get in the film reminds me of something right out of Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome.
And two men entered and only one man left.
Right. And so I like that there, as you mentioned, Thrasher, there is a lot of changes in the plot. You think everything's going to go smoothly because Snake is a badass and knows how to use all these weapons and all this shit, right? But things go wrong.
Well, they come up with interesting complications, like, you know, right off the bat with the president being captured, and they even send the president's finger to show that they're serious. I love it even that the assistant, who all he does is start counting down just to get the guards to leave. And then, you know, when Plissken's supposed to be following this tracker that the president's supposed to have on him, but then it turns out that they took the tracker from the president and gave it to this bum who's clearly crazy. It changes the whole nature, you know, of the chase. And then, of course, Isaac Hayes is the Duke.
Well, before we get to Isaac Hayes, what do you think of Adrienne Barbeau as Maggie?
I liked her because she wasn't a beautiful assistant. She was a competent character. With her own drives and with, you know, her own skills, she was a badass, and I love that they made her the equal of any man in this movie.
You know, I think she's sexy. I like tall women, right?
Oh, she was.
Even
she's
though
an
I'm
Amazon.
Short, yeah, I'm 5'5", right? I'm not a tall guy by any means. But I think she's cute. I think I wish she would have had a little bit more to do in the movie. I think she could have used some character development, but at the end of the day, the movie is about the plot. It has to keep on having forward momentum. You literally have the ticking clock of not only they're trying to rescue the fucking president of the United States, but with the thing they injected the snake with, if he doesn't do it by this certain time, he's going to have like an embolism, right? He's going to like...
Yeah, the two main
stroke.
Arteries in his head are going to explode.
Right, so but he has no choice.
But even beyond that, there's a ticking clock outside of New York because the president was on his way to some special conference with the leaders of China and Russia. And, you know, he has some MacGuffin in his briefcase. And I love that they never explain what that's about. You just have to read between the lines to figure out what's up with the cassette in his briefcase.
Yeah, and it's nice that it's a film that it rewards you on repeat viewings, but not because the film is so obtuse that you're like, I don't know what the hell I just watched, like a David Lynch film or something. But, and I say that liking David Lynch, and yet you can rewatch it and pick up on little lines of dialogue, little stuff in the background, maybe in the back of a graffiti on the wall in the corner, and kind of invent your own story and fill. Like we said, this film gives you a lot of opportunity to fill in the blanks. I think its sparseness is a strength, not a weakness. Isaac Hayes, as you mentioned, as the Duke, is quite good and quite imposing. I mean, when I saw this film, it was after 1997, and South Park was popular.
Well, yeah, this would have been made before Isaac Hayes was a joke, but also before Isaac Hayes had redeemed himself for being a joke.
Isaac Hayes was an extraordinarily successful musician with a lot of platinum albums, not the least of which was the soundtrack to Shaft, the original starring Richard Roundtree, not the mediocre remake. Why haven't we done Shaft on the sequel cast? I'm kind of shocked.
I don't know,
about
but
that.
We should.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or Dolomite.
Did they do more than one Dolomite?
The Human Tornado is a sequel to Dolomite.
But yeah, Isaac Hayes is good. I mean, he had a string of roles as an actor. He is dead. He's been dead for a bit now, right? Wasn't it like in 2008?
Yeah, in fact, he is still dead.
Yep, died in 2008. I got that right. Wow. You know, when I think of Isaac Hayes, I think of he made an appearance late. I think it might have been like a few months before he died. He was publicizing some book he came out with on the Adam Carolla show. and the sound engineer on the fly captured audio of Isaac Hayes saying, like, mm-hmm, yeah, I agree, and basically played the audio in the middle when Isaac Hayes was doing the interview. So Adam Carolla and his co-host especially didn't catch on. So they would say something controversial, and then before Isaac Hayes could answer, the sound guy would dub in the clip like, mm-hmm, I agree. And they kept that as a running joke even after Isaac Hayes died.
They would just have that play.
Yeah, they'd had like a bed of clips of Isaac Hayes going, no, I didn't say that. What you talking about?
But it's awesome because, I mean, he really was known for that deep voice, and they get some good use out of that voice in this movie. But I love that he's not some big Darth Vader of an antagonist. He's just the guy that, with his iron fist, keeps order in what's left of New York. And he has like just enough screen time to be menacing, just enough screen time to do what he needs to do. And I love his car and that motorcade that he's in, and how everywhere he goes, there's that awesome beat that follows him.
Yeah, it has a lot of funk to it. A bit of
announcing his presence,
and then he has the little tiny chandeliers.
Well, yeah, he has the chandeliers in the front of his car and the disco ball great. Instead of a rear view mirror.
Yeah, it just says so much about the character, and he's imposing. You get a fist fight with him. I mean, Isaac Hayes was in movies like Car Wash, which was a comedy. He starred in a few action pictures. A blaxploitation, you might say, if you like that term.
He was also 70s, cast against type in Oblivion and Oblivion 2 Backlash, where he plays this you know, big tough guy in the Wild West planet who speaks with his high-pitched voice. And there's nothing more horrific than hearing Isaac Hayes doing a high-pitched voice.
Is it him doing the high-pitched voice?
Yeah, it's not treated. It's just him talking like this. It's like the world's worst Muppet voice.
That sounds horrendous. I don't think I could sit through more than 5 minutes of that.
Well, hopefully no one will ever vote for that series to be a series we cover. Okay, people, vote in next time. Oblivion and Oblivion 2 Backlash. We're going to cover it.
Hashtag SequelCast loves Oblivion.
Hashtag work it. I'm going to start that, by the way.
Yeah, you go right ahead, Thrasher. I wish you the best of luck. So we've talked a lot about this film while not talking about it much at all.
Yeah, just see the film. Just watch the movie.
I recently did an article as part of my Sequel Saturday column about the upcoming remake for Escape from New York for Battleship Retention. And I made a comment there without having seen the film in a while, but I still stand by it. I think Escape from New York is a good John Carpenter film. I don't think it's a great John Carpenter film. And I think it's missing that extra punch. Like, I don't think the story is quite as compelling to me as something like In the Mouth of Madness, which I think is a real fun Lovecraftian tale.
Oh, I love that movie.
And to be honest, I need to watch more of John Carpenter's movies. I've never seen the original Halloween. Mm-hmm.
It is worth your time.
You know, John Carpenter was supposed to direct and write H2O. And then that fell through.
Oh, I did hear about that.
It definitely would have been a better picture.
Is that the one with Coolio?
No, that's Halloween Resurrection. It also has the chick that played Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica, Katie Sackhoff. So, Escape from New York. I give it 3.5 out of 5 stars.
I'm going to give it 4. I loved this. I love this so much. I love that it took its time. I even love the fact that you can see the holes in production. I love the unusual lens flares you get because of the fires and the natural light that they're using and the film stock. Like, this film is an artifact, and I've got to give it nothing but props for that.
And the end of the film is a nice kind of fuck you ending. Even though he saves the president, there's a little bit of a twist that is nice.
It's a very British president.
Yeah, it's a very British twist, right? It could come straight out of Benny Hill or something like that.
No, that's nothing to do with Benny Hill. Benny Hill would that's not Benny Hill's type of humor. Would you want to actually talk about
the music? Sure, we'll talk about the ending. So,
yeah, so the big MacGuffin is that
the
president was supposed to bring this tape, this very important tape, to this peace conference. So when he's finally gets out of New York, when he escapes from New York, you know, they set him up to do this national broadcast, which will be seen by the people at the peace conference, where he's finally going to play the tape. But Pliskin has replaced the tape with one of Cabby's swing music tapes.
Right. Yeah, or something like that.
Yeah, so the president loses is embarrassed, loses a tremendous amount of face. You could read a lot into what might happen in the aftermath of that incident, especially if you read between the lines about what's actually on the tape that they were after.
Yes, because you get a scene earlier where the cabbie accidentally, or he has the tape on him or something. He plays the tape in the cab.
Yeah, and you get the briefest snippet of what's on the tape, which involves some technical jargon. What is implied is that the whole reason they're going to this peace conference is America has developed a new bomb and wants to threaten China and Russia into not threatening them. And that's what the tape is about.
And the great part about the switcheroo at the ending is, like, Snake Plissken doesn't give a fuck. He wouldn't have done the mission had his life not been threatened with the injection he got.
Yeah.
And now that he's done, he's like, fuck you, I'm out, peace out.
Yeah, he's even offered a job, and nope, he's not going to take it.
Right, and that's part of the whole anti-hero thing. You see him walking off in the distance. Well, let's do pitch a sequel. Let's pretend Escape from L.A. didn't happen. I know there's fans of this film that pretend like Escape from L.A. never happened. And let's see, what would you do if you had to pitch a new adventure for Snake Plissken?
Okay, I would do Escape from Detroit. And so what happened in this one, you know, it's the same messed up future. Maybe this one will take place in 1999, which is nice and significant, maybe even on the eve of, like, the new millennium. And so what happens in this one is that Detroit isn't a maximum security prison. Detroit is a quarantine zone that apparently at some point between the 80s and 1999, now, a weapon was released. It could have been chemical, nuclear, biological, but it went over in Detroit, and of course, the President of the United States tried to make it look like it was Russia or China's fault, but it wasn't. It was an accident with an American-made weapon. And so Detroit got quarantined. Well, it just so turns out that whatever this weapon was is now starting to cause problems outside the quarantine zone. And if there's any cure for this biological weapon, it's going to be in the quarantine zone where the original lab was, because they were hoping that they could immunize their own soldiers against this weapon if they ever had to use it. So Snake once again gets waylaid and forced into going into the wasteland of Detroit to find the laboratory and get this information. And in fact, it turns out there's a bit of a double cross, because it turns out he's not being sent in to find the cure. He's being sent in so that they can eliminate the one surviving scientist from the project who has the cure, because an ultimate weapon is less ultimate if there's a way to protect people from it.
What would it be called?
Escape from Detroit.
Got it. I would do one where, so Snake Plissken, he has a reputation, and he's done a lot of missions in the past. He's skilled at what he does.
He has a certain set of skills.
Certain set of skills, right, as they say in the movie. And in my sequel, the Russians would hire Snake Plissken to go to an underground nuclear facility, not just underground, but underwater nuclear facility, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's a secret facility run by the U.S. government that has a nuclear bomb pointed straight at Russia. And his mission is to not disable it, but change its course so it'll hit the heart of America, of the American government, Washington, D.C., and so he takes the job because it's a lot of money, but it's a bit of a mystery. Does he betray his own country? Or does he go all in with the money and inside with the Russians. And he also, while he's doing his mission, he also has to act as a double agent to even get into the secret facility. Because if they see just like some weird guy with long hair and an eye patch and a beard, they might get suspicious. Hmm. And there'd be a montage where you get to see Snake clean up and shave off the beard and clean up the hair and take off the eye patch even and have a glass eye. And you'd see him kind of like groan through trying to look like a normal person to do the facade. And it would be called Escape from Below.
Oh, I've got a question for you. So they never explain how he gets the nickname Snake Plissken, but when he gets stripped by the Duke's boys, you see he has this cobra tattoo on his chest, but the tail of the cobra goes down past his waistband. So I got to wonder, do you think that that tattoo goes all the way down to the tip?
Not only do I think the tattoo goes all the way down to the tip, I think it sort of wraps around there, curly cues a bit. And he can make a dance on occasion.
Get ready to ride the snake.
It should be mentioned, the character of Snake Plissken is a huge influence on the popular video game character Solid Snake.
Yep.
From the Metal Gear series. Even in, I think it's either the first or the second game, he says, "I got an undercover name, call me Snake." And the actor sounds a lot like Kurt Russell in The Escape from movies.
I think that is Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah. And but even if you go back to the original games, which are Metal Gear and Metal Gear 2 for the Japanese MSX system, later released on the compilations for the PS3, I think the Complete Saga or whatever they called it, in the original Japanese artwork, the artwork for Snake looked exactly like Kurt Russell from Escape from New York. And when they brought it to the United States, they had to change every portrait. Because, like, the general looked just like Sean Connery from Hunt for the Red October.
Oh, wow.
They had to redraw everything because it was too close of a likeness. So, there's your trivia, boing. Well, let's move on to sequel news.
Ba-da-da-da-da-da.
I think there's one big one that we can talk about. You know, it's all about the comic book stuff. And a rumor that I think we've even talked about before in the show has come true. Sony is going to co-produce new Spider-Man films with Marvel. But not only that, Spider-Man is going to pop up somehow in the upcoming Captain America Civil War film.
That is going to be very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And Sony will contribute to the financing and distribution and have final creative control. But they're working with Marvel because Marvel can make a shitload more money than Sony can. It's worth saying The Amazing Spider-Man 2 is not a flop. It made like $750 million, but that's only half of what The Avengers made. And originally there was all these crazy plans that Sony was going to do an Aunt May spinoff film or do a Sinister Six film, which they might still do with Marvel. I don't know.
A Sinister Six film, I think that has some legs.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you see that DC is doing their... can you give me the name of that? I can't remember. The bad guy film?
Oh, Suicide Squad.
Suicide Squad, there you go. Right? So it'd be kind of like the Marvel version of that, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, and they're going to go with a new actor, go with someone younger.
As always. What,
yes, and something that people are trying to, there's been a few, more than a few articles online, especially by Devin Faraci at BadassDigest.com, is should they go with the Spider-Man character that is, what is his, was it Morales, he's Latino?
Miles Morales.
Miles Morales, there you go. I haven't read those comics myself, but if they went as someone that wasn't a white dude for Spider-Man, that's not necessarily Peter Parker, I think that'd be one way to freshen up the series.
Well, I mean, even then, you could still make Peter Parker black. I don't think being Caucasian is
right.
Intrinsic to the Peter Parker character.
No, and a lot reportedly a lot of minorities like Spider-Man because they can dress up as him for Halloween and nobody questions them on it because the entire body is covered with a suit.
Huh. That had never occurred to me.
Yeah. So
and
there's
actually,
a bit of
one,
yeah.
One of the there is a campaign to get Donald Glover to fill the role of Spider-Man.
Yes,
the actor from Community and Derek Comedy raps under the name Childish Gambino.
Yep. I don't know if that will happen realistically, but that would be good. I mean, I think the way to go with Spider-Man after Sony made things like super serious is to make it a bit lighter. Not as light as something like the Lego movie, have you? But and also because of this, they're going to have Spider-Man films, and it's bumped out the Marvel release dates a bit, too, to squeeze Spider-Man films in there. And Spider-Man will likely pop up in things like Infinity War and so forth. So I think this is pretty exciting. This is what a lot of fans wanted. Does Marvel get Spider-Man back outright? Well, no. And I don't think Sony will ever let them do that. This co-production, I think, is as good a thing as we can hope for. The one mistake they absolutely can't make when we get the first standalone Spider-Man film is to do an origin story once again. There's no fucking way they can get away with that.
I'd say what I would love to see an origin story if it took place in the 1960s, just like the original comic.
Would you make that like about the first Spider-Man then? Is that how you would do it?
It would be the Spider-Man, but do it as a period piece set when the comic originally came out.
What, so that means he's going to be like in his 60s or something by the
time
he's...
None of it takes place in the modern day. You make the whole thing a period piece.
What about Spider-Man appearing in Captain America: Civil War?
Which that'll be its own separate thing.
Happen. Yeah.
We'll have a separate Spider-Man that exists in the Marvel in the Marvel's Marvel movies, and then Sony can have its own Spider-Man. And the mother has custody every other weekend.
Well, speaking of which, David Koepp, who wrote one of the drafts of the screenplay to Sam Raimi's first Spider-Man film, perhaps the second, I don't recall, he mentioned that if he was to be in charge of Spider-Man, he would have three Spider-Man franchises happening simultaneously. You'd have like Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, and something else. But basically, like, one would be the more traditional old school Spider-Man, one would be the kind of darker, hard PG-13 version, and one would be something else. And so that way you'd have different Spider-Man films for different audiences continually being in the cinemas each year.
Huh.
Which would confuse people, I think.
I don't know. I'd give people more credit than that.
What's a piece of sequel news you find interesting out there?
You can call this interesting. So Tony Hale from Buster from Arrested Development, he has signed on to play the antagonist in the fourth, count it fourth, Alvin and the Chipmunks movie, Alvin and the Chipmunks 4, Road Chip.
Truly being called Road Chip.
Yep, Road Chip.
I've only ever seen the first one, and I cracked a smile at a line of dialogue where the chipmunks start talking, and then Dave faints, and there's an extended pause. They think he's dead, and then Simon calmly explains to the other chipmunks how to dispose of the body.
Wow.
It's a shockingly dark moment.
Well, I won't be seeing that, as I have to devote my time to analyzing Chipmunks 2, The Squeakquel, for the Squeakquel cast.
When is that coming out?
With any luck, next month.
There you go. Alvin Ford, you know, Tony Hale, I think, could to be a good job. That's so hard, though. It's like when they did Roger Rabbit. You're reacting against nothing the whole time.
Yeah, but they still did it well in Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, and I have to say, the CG redesigns of the chipmunks are pretty good, all things considered. I think they capture what those characters are. That the chipmunks have been around for over 50 years at this point is flabbergasting.
Yeah, I think we know what that witch doctor was really up to.
Ooh-ee-ooh-ah-ah-ching-ching, walla-walla-bean-bean. No?
It's a ting-tang, walla-walla-bing-bang. And if you say it all three times, you'll summon something.
I'm not going to bother to try that out.
A wise decision.
I think so. Well, let's move on to what you're watching. thrashers or something you've enjoyed watching the past week?
Yes. I'm finally getting caught up on Psychoville, and I watched the Psychoville Christmas special, which was a Halloween special.
And what is Psychoville again?
Oh, Psychoville, it's a dark comedy created by the League of Gentlemen, a team of British comedians and performers. They play all the Vogons in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie from a few years ago.
Got it.
So Psychoville, it's this dark comedy about serial killers and people with these sort of extreme personalities. The first season begins with seven completely different people. You don't know how they're connected, but they each get a handwritten letter that says simply, "I know what you did." And from there, the series explores how they're all connected, what their mysterious pasts are like, why they have the condition that they're in. And the first series ends on this ridiculous, like, it's a cliffhanger that is outright impossible in so many ways. So between series one and series two, they did a Christmas special, which is done in the style of a Halloween special, which is really dark and creepy. It's like at times they forget that it's supposed to have funny moments, but what's really fascinating about it is that it purports to tell the origin stories of some of the characters, but these origin stories are being told by unreliable narrators, so they could all be completely false. But at the end, it does tie directly into events in series one, so it's very, very fun.
I got to see a special on HBO called Mel Brooks Live at the Geffen. It was a new live show Mel Brooks did. It runs about an hour.
Did he interview a 2,000-year-old man?
Carl Reiner is in the audience as a surprise, but they don't really do a 2,000-year-old man bit. They sort of reminisce. And, you know, I have to say, it's good. It's not great. Part of the reason is I've been watching on a lot of Mel Brooks interviews recently. He did, like, an extended one with Conan O'Brien. That was pretty good for his web series. And so the first half of these stories that I've really heard before. But Mel Brooks is a great entertainer. I think he's like 90 years old now. If not, he's pretty close to it. And he can still work the crowd. The second half of the show, I think, is more entertaining. He performs, in some cases, these are covers of classic songs from his hit movies. Wow. With his warbly voice. And he also does a song that he wrote with a fellow collaborator of his that never got used in anything, that it sounds like maybe they were thinking of using it for History of the World or something, where it's a musical number about the values of retreating in war in the style of the French. And it's like a 10-minute number that he does.
Wow.
Called Retreat, Retreat, and Mel Brooks thinks it's the best song he's ever written. I don't agree with that. But, I mean, some of the songs he performs are pretty obscure. He performs the title song from the 12 Chairs, which is a Mel Brooks film few people have ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
Hope for the best, forget the worst. No,
I thought it was
expect
hope for
the best,
prepare for the worst.
No, hope for the best, expect the worst. Someday you're Tolstoy or Fanny Hurst. So don't forget, friends. Yeah, that part's pretty fun. He has piano accompaniment, and he has some stories that were not new to me. But if you're not a Mel Brooks, not like I am, you'll get a kick out of it. It's nice to see him still kicking. He recently was on a podcast with Adam Carolla, in which he says he really wants to make a Spaceballs 2, and it all depends if they can convince Rick Moranis
to come out of retirement.
To come on. And a few years ago, Rick Moranis came out with another comedy music album. And people, of course, were asking him, what do you do with Spaceballs 2? And he said, well, a few years ago, Mel made me an offer, and the money was so low, I think the ship has sailed. And I think the last thing that Rick Moranis did for a movie was the voice of a moose in Brother Bear, a Disney feature-length animated 2D cartoon.
direct to DVD, I believe.
No, that was in theaters. He might have done the voice for the direct to video sequel.
Oh yeah. You know, actually, speaking of Mel Brooks, it just occurred to me, I watched the Mel Brooks documentary Make a Noise.
I saw that, too. I thought that was great. That was better than this live show on HBO.
It was very informative. Lots of stuff I didn't know.
It gets pretty touching when he talks about his late wife, Anne Bancroft.
Yeah.
What was your favorite sort of Mel Brooks story from that?
I don't know. Well, I love that bit about him in, like, with the Signal Corps in World War II. Or maybe it wasn't the Signal Corps, but where they heard, like, German propaganda being broadcasted, so he just started, like, broadcasting show tunes back at them.
Yes, yeah, he tells that story at the HBO show as well.
Oh, and also the story about how he was working with this young director about how, like, showing him how to get more money out of a studio executive by catching them after lunch. I love that. That was strategy.
That's right. I think in that one, in the end credits, he gives some health advice where stay away from candy. If you really want something sweet, go for an orange. Not only is it sweet from its natural juices, but you get that extra zip from the fiber within the fruit.
Cleans you right out.
Yeah, it seems like he's being serious, but his delivery is pretty good. But it's been way too long since Mel Brooks has made a movie. But at this age, like, I don't know.
If they can do the Expendables, why not do the ultimate Mel Brooks reunion?
The
movie?
Comedy Expendables. That's what I want to see.
The Explodables, we'll call it.
Well, the thing is, Mel Brooks said, you know, we got Star Wars 7 coming out. If we can come out with Spaceballs within 3 months of the release of Star Wars 7, we're bound to make our money back. Out of all of Mel Brooks' movies, Spaceballs far and away is the best seller on home video.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't it like the worst performing in the theater, too?
No, it wasn't the worst performing, but it did okay. Like, it didn't do great. But then on video, it just got a huge release, and everybody keeps on introducing it to their kids, I guess. And on some interview, I heard Mel Brooks say he wishes that they would have put more jokes in Spaceballs, that they spent too much time developing the characters and the plot.
Huh.
Because it does have a very classical sort of fairy tale structure.
Well, of all of his movies, it probably has the tightest plot.
Right.
You know, it doesn't meander like something like High Anxiety does.
A lot of Mel Brooks stuff meanders and seems to go from gag to gag as fast as possible.
Which I love. Like, I love rapid-fire comedies.
Yes, and if you want to hear us talk more about Mel Brooks, look at sequelcast.com. We did a special on Mel Brooks, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. It's worth checking out. There's also a video of that at youtube.com/sequelcast. So I think it is time.
Time? Time for the Paul Goebel Show Memorial Mashup?
That's right. Why don't you explain what that is to our fine listeners?
Well, what I do is I take two different impressions, combine them into one impression, do a little playlet to clue people in, and Matt and our guests have to figure out what that combined impression is. And the name of that combined impression will always be a combination of the characters or actors or figures involved. So, are you ready?
I am.
You get up every morning at the Bonsai Compound's warning, take the big tour bus into the city, perform some brain surgery, then put on a rock concert, and then there's this girl, her name's Penny Pretty. There's some electrodes in the sky, and they're gonna make us die, unless we get John Wharfin one day. But if you ever get annoyed, look at me, I'm played by Jeff Goldblum, and also there's Peter Weller in this movie.
Okay, so it has something to do with a movie I've never seen, despite the fact people scream at me to watch it. I've only caught clips of it on Comedy Central. So that has something to do with Buckaroo Banzai.
If you've never seen the movie, you're not going to get this, but I'll still give you a shot.
Okay. I've never seen it. The melody of the song sounded vaguely familiar. It would have been probably a song from the 50s or the 60s. And, yeah, that's it.
Okay, that was Bachman-Turner Overthruster.
And so what's the part that has to do with the Buckaroo Banzai?
Okay, in Buckaroo Banzai Beyond the Eighth Dimension, the whole movie hinges on a piece of technology called an oscillation overthruster.
There you go.
Developed by the Banzai Institute.
And they came out with like a comic sequel to Buckaroo Banzai, did they not?
I believe they did, although sadly I have not seen it. There was an attempt to get an animated series made that was going to be CGI. There was also an attempt, I think, to do a video game.
Hmm.
Oh, but you know what? This is something that kept coming back to me, watching Escape from New York. I'm actually shocked there isn't a video game based on this yet.
Yeah, the structure of the movie is a lot like a video game, isn't it? Right? Where you're going from, like, different location. There's a lot of fights to be had.
Antagonists.
Set pieces. Antagonist. A lot of danger. You know, there's apparently an Escape from New York board game that was released by TSR in 1981.
Tactical Studies rules.
Yeah, let's see. Apparently, for a while, John Carpenter was trying to get a third Escape from New York made that would have taken place in outer space.
Huh. Where else do you go, really?
I guess, yeah, that never happened. So they're still trying to cast a new Snake Plissken movie. They're trying to work on it. This is weird. They say the film for the Escape from New York remake is inspired by the video game Batman Arkham City.
Which,
I guess I can see that, right? Because, well, like, the city is a prison.
Well,
man,
Arkham City in
out.
Itself is inspired in part by Escape from New York. So it's this Ouroboros thing.
The snake eats its own tail, swallows, vomits it up, and then eats it again.
And Zelda reclaims her own.
That's a bit of sequel news we didn't mention. Did you know that the rumors is that Netflix might be producing a live-action Legend of Zelda film that's described as Game of Thrones for a family audience?
I have heard that.
I don't think that's an awful idea. I mean, considering all we've had as official licensed Zelda stuff is a not very good cartoon from the 80s.
Oh, yeah, that used to appear as a segment on the Super Mario Brothers Super Show.
Well, excuse me, princess. Yeah. Came out on the Friday. Man, you know, but you know, whether that actually happens, whether it comes out, I mean, also reportedly, Sony wants to produce a Super Mario Brothers animated feature film.
Hmm.
So, who the hell knows? I mean, I think people...
Well, maybe that's the Lego movie people were behind it.
I think I would love to see Terry Gilliam do a Super Mario Brothers movie.
Oh,
that's
wow.
Never going to happen.
With Johnny Depp and Bob Hoskins.
Can you use CG to recreate Bob Hoskins and then use audio clips from his different movies to piece together dialogue?
They could use a Muppet for it.
A Muppet. Mario is Luigi, Super Mario Brothers.
That would be a great twist.
Yeah, I don't know what you... I still think those 90s Mario Brothers cartoons and the ones from the 80s kind of had the right track. Just do a Saturday morning cartoon. I think.
Where they just kind of dumped Mario into different situations.
Right, yeah, I think that's the way to go. Zelda, I can see there's more potential for a massive series, but then, you know, like Link talks, people would complain about. People would complain about every little thing.
Yeah,
no,
but you can't
right.
let that stop you.
No, and the Zelda games really are light on plot compared to something like a Final Fantasy, right?
Well, I'm not going to say the Final Fantasy games have plot. They have a convoluted series of incidents.
They have more of a epic scale than Legend of Zelda, where... Every game, or most of the games, are you got to go through 8 dungeons, get a special item from each dungeon, then go to the last dungeon and beat the boss.
Yeah, but the games all transcend time, space, death, and reality.
If you ever see the official Nintendo canon timeline for the Legend of Zelda series, it's hilarious. Because it's like a different Zelda comes every age, but then at one point this splits. Food for thought. Next week, we're talking about Escape from L.A. Snake Plissken.
Do we love
goes,
L.A.? Find out next week.
Short people have no reason to live. For the sequel cast, where can people catch you at, Thrasher?
They can catch me on Twitter at InternetMayor.
Catch me on Twitter at SequelCast. Check out the Facebook page, facebook.com/SequelCast. Get past episodes of the SequelCast at SequelCast.com. Also, if you're in the Portland, Oregon area, Tuesday nights, 8 to 10 p.m., I do a pub quiz for geeks who drink at the Iconic Lounge. Check it out.
Very
cool.
For
the SequelCast, this is Matt.
And this is Thrasher.
Saying,
what did you do to me?
I'm not jacking off here. Where's the drop point?
Give me the map.
I got infected nodules in my vocal cords. Can you help me?
I need to speak with the Duke.
Patty cake, baker's man. Bake me a cake. Fast as he can.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, kick your ass.
The Sequel Cast is a Hipster Goblin production.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.